Welcome to Afronomics, a podcast where we discuss transformative ideas for African economies in the 21st century. I'm Andrew Davalen, Chief Economist for the Africa region of the World Bank. In every episode, we bring a big idea to the table and explore its implications for development practitioners, policymakers, and most importantly, the people they serve, African citizens. Today, we are continuing the conversation about electricity access and inviting new perspectives to the table. In this episode, we will continue our conversation on Mission 300. Joining me are two colleagues deeply involved in the World Bank's Mission 300 initiative, which aims to connect 300 million people in sub-Saharan Africa to electricity by 2030. I have my colleagues Franz Dries Gross, Director of Infrastructure for Africa West and Central, and Eric Magnus Farnstrom, who is the Director for Infrastructure for Africa East and South. Franz and Eric, welcome to Afronomics.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Good to be here.
Excellent. So let's start right away. What is Mission 300 about?
Well, Andrew, as you mentioned, it is a bold goal set by the World Bank Group and the African Development Bank to connect 300 million residential consumers to electricity by 2030. And just to frame that a little bit, there are about 680 million people worldwide that don't have electricity access. About 580 million live in sub-Saharan Africa. So this basically provides electricity access to about half of those people by 2030. But then N300 is also about much more than just last mile electricity access for people using on-grid or off-grid solutions. It's a deep program of sector reform, basically designed to turn around African electricity sectors and to ensure that both customers who are already connected and those new customers we will connect get continuous high quality electricity supply. Just let me close by saying maybe this initial observation is that if you look at what we're actually spending money on under the M300 initiative during the first 2 years, about half is going to electricity generation, transmission, distribution system reinforcement to make sure that those new customers, but also the existing residential and industrial customers, get more reliable power in greater amounts.
Eric, is there anything you want to add to that?
No, I think what Franz is stressing is that it's a program that has a headline target on access. But really, when you look at the compacts and the broader program, it equally emphasizes affordability and reliability. It's access for everyone, the ones that are currently connected but are still struggling, as well as the ones that have yet to be connected.
Okay, fantastic. So we'll get into a discussion around reliability, access, who, and so on. So let's just break down this a little bit. So this is not just households. It's going to be also enterprises, offices, and so on and so on. Do we have a sense of like what the breakdown is likely to be between how much of this is going to be household connections, how much of this is going to be businesses, and so on? Or is that not entirely established at the moment?
I don't know that we have a numeric breakdown, because we should keep in mind and maybe separate the groups in two. If we think about the bucket that is access extension, we are prioritizing areas based on expected load. The higher the load we can pick up, the more viable and easy for the utility to serve. So we pick up all the eligible customers and ideally as many businesses as we possibly can connect, right? But it depends on the area and the activities. And we should also keep in mind that it's a very organic process. When you connect a new area, there may be a few businesses, let's say, running gen sets in that area that can be initial anchor customers on the company side. But businesses and people very quickly cluster in, right, from the surrounding areas, right? So you have an organic effect of load growth, both on the household level, but primarily at the business level, seizing on this new tool and resource that they want to use. Now, on the connected side, on the reliability and affordability level, we have all the data from the utility in terms of the businesses they serve. They're often covered in a separate tariff, etc. But here, again, the biggest issue is really not so much the price, if you look at company service, but really reliability and having to recourse back to self-generation at very high cost.
Indeed. So Franz, let me come to you. So reliability is a really, really big issue. 71% of African businesses complain about reliability of electricity. You know, compared to, say, 29% in Europe and Central Asia, or even 26% in other places. So how severe is reliability in Africa, West and Central, for example? And how does Mission 300 think about fixing that problem?
Well, let me give you one example of the consequences of that unreliability, just to frame the discussion, then tell you about how M300 is approaching it. Take Nigeria. It's the country with the single biggest access deficit on the continent, actually worldwide. 85 million Nigerians without electricity access today. Though Nigeria has about the same population as Brazil, it uses about 1/20th of the electricity that Brazil does. About 5,000 megawatts of power are dispatched to the grid from central producers that then feed the electricity transmission company and then to the distribution companies. But at the same time, while 5,000 megawatts are being dispatched to the network, people are self-supplying to the tune of about 29,000 megawatts. So all those companies complaining about not having continuous access, they're self-supplying. They have to keep diesel generators in reserve to compensate for what they're not getting to the grid, from the grid. So then you take a step back and say, well, wait a minute. So if the people who are already connected aren't really getting the service they want, and if on top of that, there's 85 million people who haven't even been connected to the grid, what does it take to solve that problem? And you quickly realize it isn't just a matter of extending networks to new customers or serving people in rural areas with off-grid solutions. There's a real challenge of sector reform in five broad areas. And I think that's something that's really worth bringing out on M300. This is about reform, not just more financing. So what we've done is, together with the African Development Bank, we've worked with 29 countries in sub-Saharan Africa to basically work out the reforms they need to make under five broad chapters. And I'll go into them in just a moment. But the basic idea is what countries do under each of those chapters is unique to that country. But the fact that you need to address progress in five broad areas, that's something that countries agree upon, and that's actually been adopted by the African Union. So the first chapter is bringing down the cost of generation. Why is that? Basically, even the people who have electricity access in Africa tend to pay a lot more money per kilowatt hour than do industrial customers or residential customers in most developed countries. So how do you bring down that generation cost? One is you do more of the things that cost less, so newer, cheaper sources of generation. And second, do them in the right way. Instead of doing single source deals with companies providing a generation to the grid, you basically do competitive procurement to select them. So get rid of diesel generation, get rid of heavy fuel oil. Both of those are dirty and expensive, and move much more into renewables, but also into gas to power to bring down the cost of generation. And second, procure those new sources of generation by competition. The second pillar is if you can't produce it yourself, import it from your neighbors. So you have four big power pools in Africa. Basically, get more countries interconnected so that if they can't produce cheaply, they can at least source it from their neighbors who can. The third thing is to set very clear goals. How am I going to electrify people? How am I going to provide them with clean cooking solutions? All of this is a least cost electricity mapping that needs to be done. The fourth pillar that all countries are addressing that are part of M300 is how do you eliminate the barriers to private investment, both in the off-grid side and the on-grid side? And the fifth one, and equally important, is turning around the distribution utilities. Right now, about 58% of African power utilities don't even cover their operating costs. Never mind any capital expenditure or debt service, not even the plain vanilla operating costs. And the reason for those poorly served customers is that these utilities aren't covering their costs and a lot of times aren't paying the generators, which causes these service disruptions resulting in poor service quality.
Excellent. So you laid this out, these five pros. So let me come to you, Eric. So let's take the last point that Franz just mentioned, which is about getting utilities to function properly, right? How do you do that? Is there a place where you're doing that in Southern Africa?
I mean, look, it's not a silver bullet, right? It's a constant push and a dialogue we have with governments. Obviously, revenue increases in terms of tariff is highly unpopular and should be, right? And the ability for a lot of these companies to reform and become more efficient quickly is also hard, right? So you often find yourself in a hole where you have to kind of dig yourself out gradually through reduction in losses, more efficient operations, better planning, which means better choices of new investments, right? And a tweaking of the sort of the commercial end, right? You need to collect your bills. You know, you need to serve your customers in a way that a private business would, et cetera, et cetera. So some utilities, I mean, I can take Kenya Power as an example, have actually come back up now. They've posted some modest profit the last couple of years, and that's reflected on the share price since they are partly privately held. But most utilities are really struggling in this space, right? But we are using the compacts really to create a common platform. What needs to be done and how do we sequence it? So, and how, obviously then how do we support it with bank financed program, partners, etc.
So let me come back to questions on affordability, right? So when you say, okay, one of the pillars of this reform plan is getting electricity cheaper, can you elaborate on that? What do you mean, getting electricity cheaper?
Well, let me just give you the example of Senegal, for example. So Senegal is about 70% thermal generation right now. And a lot of that is diesel or heavy fuel oil generation. As I said, both dirty and expensive. So replacing a lot of that, that thermal generation by a combination of renewables, so much more wind and solar, particularly solar in the Senegalese case, and since that renewable generation tends to be intermittent, basically hybridizing that with gas to power, which is much cleaner and continuous than the diesel and the heavy fuel oil. So part of the equation, basically most of the costs that end users see stem from high generation costs. The costs of transmission distribution tend to be relatively modest compared to the generation weight in the overall end user bill, right? So you have to attack the cost of generation. The other thing is, and Eric started to say this, is you have to bill your customers and then you have to invoice them, right? A lot of customers, a lot of utilities we have in West and Central Africa only invoice 50 or 60% of the power that they generate. And then of those 50 or 60%, they only collect half, right? So out of 10 units generated, sometimes you collect revenue from three, right? So addressing both this under invoicing, basically commercial and technical losses, and then the failure to collect from the people that you have invoiced, that's the other side of the equation. So bring down the cost, increase the revenue, get to operational cost recovery.
What's preventing these agencies, utility agencies, from collecting the revenues they're owed?
Well, I think it can be a number of issues, obviously, right? If we start at the technology end, we often find that sort of the commercial systems are, in many cases, archaic. The ability to follow up on bills and you know, actually get paid or even have a very thorough and trusting relationship with key accounts, right? I mean, a lot of utilities act more as the strong arm on the state rather than a commercial entity actually providing a service and asking for a fair pay in return, right? So it's a mindset change in state utilities to act, to behave more like a private company that actually have to care about revenue. But it is also an investment need in terms of systems, prepayment meters, billing systems, ERP systems, etc., that private companies would be very familiar with, but SOEs often are not. But let's be clear, there are also aspects of governance, right? There are public clients, for instance, that don't expect to pay. And we are also having a dialogue on that, right? But that's a broader issue in many countries, that there are, you know, entities within the public sphere that consider themselves above these kind of things, right?
Okay, so you have this reform plan that is supposed to change the financial stability of these utilities. And yet you have all these problems that you're raising, right? In terms of inability to collect, the political environment in which they operate. You know, what is the reform itself going to do to change that environment, that context?
So Eric outlined it very nicely. There are breakdowns at various levels, right? So one is, of course, the non-payment by public customers, state-owned enterprises, government ministries, et cetera. So one way to address that is to basically divide that universe of public consumers into the disconnectable ones and the non-disconnectable ones. So you might say, for example, you'll never disconnect a hospital for non-payment. You're never going to deprive the patient lying on the operating table of electricity in the middle of an operation. Of course you won't. But you might well disconnect the Ministry of Public Works or the Ministry of Health or some other government offices if they don't pay. So the strategy is define very clearly who you are willing to disconnect and put those people on prepayment meters so that they prepay their consumption, and when they've burned through that, the lights go out. On the private side, there's a lot of customers that actually aren't metered, or that have meters don't work properly, et cetera. So increasing the number of people with smart meters, with prepayment meters, just as like you prepay some cell phone plans, for example. You use up a certain amount of consumption, then you have to top up your plan to get more minutes on your cell phone. It's the same thing you can do with electricity. Another one is deep governance issues. Sometimes you have rogue employees of power utilities that will run a connection to your house, take a kickback, and then run a bypass around the meter. Or if you slip them $50, they may not even report you to the commercial department in the same utility. So the utility may have given you a meter, but their commercial department never recognizes you as a customer. So there's all kinds of things that are sort of in that government sphere. But the good news is you can make a dent in these problems. And there are utilities, even ones operating in difficult, poor contexts, that have managed to turn things around. Liberia is a great case of a post-FCV country in which the utility has completely turned around its commercial situation.
How related are these financial difficulties and reliability of electricity?
I mean, they are very related because, should we call it zombie utilities, utilities that live kind of in the shadowlands of not being able to invest in their operation, not able to lean forward, constantly firefighting, begging for government subsidies, are not entities that are able to lean into aspects of quality service, you know, and they're also not able to tap the opportunities of technology. And I think I wanted to come to that, Andrew, because I think it's been missing a lot. We talk about utilities and billing and all these networks like nothing has changed, right? And maybe listeners would think, you know, it's the same energy sector as it was in the 70s. But there's a tremendous opportunity for African utilities to actually leapfrog a number of technologies from the solar side and the ability to both do distributed as well as large scale renewables and batteries to lower their cost, right? To, you know, all the aspects of digitalization, right, including digitalization of data. I mean, part of the governance issue is that a lot of this data on who paying, for instance, and service quality is so opaque, right? With our various tools on geospatial and other metering data that we could collect, the government has much more of an ability as the systems are upgraded to actually go after our customers that are not paying or identifying clusters of losses and weaknesses in a way that, you know, was stuck in drawers 20, 30 years ago, right? So it's really a different orbit that we're dealing with right now, both for the grid connected as well as for the off-grid side.
Excellent. So you've clarified now what Mission 300 is all about, connections to households, but also a whole lot to businesses. But I think what was coming out in both in the discussions in recent, you know, the recent meetings, but also in all the debates around Mission 300, and also just in all this debate about our attempt to create jobs in Africa and link that to energy, right, is this idea of making sure that this infrastructure that we implement, whether it is energy or digital or roads, and railways, and so on, is connected to some productive use. Is Mission 300 intentional about that? Is there some intentional attempt to try and do this for Mission 300?
Yeah, let me start on this. And I think we should be honest about that. Traditionally, energy access programs have not so much focused on the use case. It has focused on connecting people and businesses, but hasn't really gone beyond that into what are they going to use the asset for, right? But we're getting very much into this space. And I think that part of this is because when you look at some of the mini grid operators, for instance, that we are supporting, they look at their business is not the connection, it's the consumption, right? So you have in the private sector a lot of best practices in terms of actually getting their consumers in a village or small town to consume more power because it's good business for them, right? So we are having an emergence sort of knowledge of good ways of supporting your rice milling or your, you know, carpentries or your irrigation schemes, etc., in a rural context, which is, you know, the kind of classic micro and SME enterprise that you see. I think for bigger companies that are already established, as I said, they will already benefit. And it's really for them a concern about reliability and continuity of the service, right? But I think this is where we can actually stimulate new business, which I think is absolutely critical to make Mission 300 sustainable and performing over time. Right?
Maybe an example would shed some light on this. Just to give you a sense, about half of the connections that are going to be made under Mission 300 are going to happen off-grid. So as Eric said, those are mini-grids, they're solar home systems installed on individual people's homes, or there's something that's in between those two called a mesh grid, where you basically network a couple of homes together. And how do these things actually get built? So the biggest electrification, off-grid electrification program we have in West Africa is in Nigeria. No wonder, it's the country with the biggest number of unserved. And the way most people we connect, and we hope to connect about 17 million people of those 85 million without power, isn't for the government to go in and to build a system somewhere. What we do is we offer a capital subsidy to different regions of the country. Then we pre-qualify private developers and private equipment manufacturers. And we basically say to those developers is, if you go to this part of the country and you talk to the community and you agree on a tariff and you build a mini grid, we will give you a capital subsidy towards the construction of that mini grid that will basically allow you to recoup about half the cost of that capital investment. The other half, you have to get it back from the community. So put people on cell phone payment plans, let them basically recover your investment through the payments that people make. Now, those private mini-grid developers, they would very much like to serve not just residential customers. They are desperate to find heavier off-takers, anchor customers that tend to be good payers. So they want to have the people using electricity for productive purposes. They want somebody doing milling. They want to do solar pumping. They want to have a company coming in with a refrigeration plant that sells refrigeration as a service. So we also, through the program, actually provide grants to get these productive uses into communities. But the very drive of the entrepreneur is to find those anchor customers. And that also works well, incidentally, with the aim of promoting not just electrical access, but digital access. Because cell phone towers need electricity. Cell phone towers in areas that aren't electrified tend to have their own generators, but that's expensive. So there's a win-win world out there where the cell phone towers go to the mini-grid operators. The mini-grid operators provide them with electricity, but they also get digital coverage in the town they've just connected so that people can then pay their bills on their cell phone, which leads to better cost recovery for the mini-grid developer. So there's a world where both sides win, right? So let me just say that if you drive the process through private investors, these mini-grid developers, their interest is to find bigger productive use customers.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
if you want to add to this.
No, I just want to just highlight that this is where private sector service delivery really excels, right? SOEs, public utilities are usually quite bad at this end, right? Load promotion, finding partnership, cell phone towers, etc., and building your loan base, right? Whereas the private, for them, this is their bread and butter, right? And this is why we see in the mini-grid space a lot more entrepreneurship, innovation, ingenuity in the rural space, which I think is very powerful for what we want to achieve.
So this off-grid component of Mission 300 is another of those issues with where there is a lot of misunderstanding, maybe either misunderstanding or lack of clarity, right? Just like the headline number 300, right? When we talk about off-grid, when it comes to Mission 300, what's the system we're talking about? Because there are some people who think, oh, okay, so this is just supplying people with, or giving people two bulbs and a charger for, you know, some solar panel on the roof that, you know, maybe charges a phone and provides two lights, to a whole range of things which you're talking about, which is, you know, a system that actually can power, you know, irrigation systems or even a rice mill or a wheat mill or a maize mill or whatever it is, right? So what is it? Like, what is the range of products that the Mission 300 is actually provide when it comes to off-grid? Who wants to take that?
So I think, first of all, you know, let's not get into this sort of false dichotomy, right? It is both, right? First of all, we should not ignore the aspects of energy poverty. Two lights and a charging point and a fan can be life-changing for people, right? And as long as that service is sustainable, that is fine, right? But we are not, there's no scheme, no mini grid scheme or other Mission 300 that says that's all we're going to give, right? The higher the aggregation of load, the more businesses that we can bring in, the easier it is actually to address energy poverty as well, right? So I think mini grids especially are very good at providing a range of services from your rice millers to the very basics. I know mini grid operators that are actually on the very lowest end or even offer hourly supply, just like, you know, our cell phone providers in Africa, right? You can say I only have a few shillings, I want power for one day, right? They're happy to provide it. They provide tailor-made solution from the very, very lowest to the highest low demand in their uptake area, right? And I think that's how it should be.
So I think it's a great question, Andrew. So the first thing is, what constitutes access? When we say 300 million people are going to have access by 2030, we do provide what we call tier one access as a minimum, which is enough for light bulbs, a cell phone charger, et cetera. But what we don't want is people to stay at a low level. People can enter at different tiers, the lowest one, tier one, tier two, tier three. And what we want everybody to do is to get on the ladder and to climb up the ladder. But the reality is that when you connect poor households, even on grid, when they could be consuming a lot, is actually their electricity consumption doesn't grow very quickly overnight. So let's forget about off-grid for a second. If you were to connect a poor family to an on-grid solution where they could theoretically overnight consume much more, the reality is since they don't have a lot of appliances, their consumption is actually quite low for a couple of years. And only over time, as they sort of their economic status overall grows, so does their consumption. So what we want to do is try to accelerate the process by which people move up the ladder.
So that's where it starts. But when you look at some of the big brands in this business, like take Sun King for instance, you can look at their offer. It's very much a ladder and it's a monthly subscription. So customers that are able to generate more income or have a good harvest, for instance, they can channel that aspiration into a higher tier supply. So which will be enough then to run a TV or run basic household appliances, or even go into at the higher tiers, tier three and up, productive appliances, whatever it is, sewing machine or other kind of processing. But the point here is that we have to also be cognizant that it's fine for a poor household to stay at the basic service that they would use also if they had unlimited grid supply, right? We know that there's a huge contingent of households that's the means they have, right? We want to provide them a growth opportunity, just like they have with the grid. You have the grid, you are free to use only two light bulbs, and some will still use two light bulbs 10 years later, right? And that's the broader issue of poverty and lack of means in Africa that we're dealing with every day, right? But just as the grid consumer have the opportunity to consume more, to adapt, get more use, the off-grid user should have the same, should not be stuck and lock into a solution that constrains them. And I think that's what we're very keen on.
So I think this is something we're looking at very carefully, and I know there's a lot of interest from a lot of rural electrification agencies, but the whole idea is how do you get people moving up the ladder? To be clear, we want people to move up the ladder wherever they enter the ladder.
That's a good question. How do you do that?
How do you do it? So at every stage of where you are on the ladder, there are some savings that you could capture and reinvest to take the next step up. So, for example, even if you were to start at tier one, right? So you've gotten a few light bulbs, you've got a cell phone charger, maybe some very, very low energy consuming appliances. You might be saving, for example, on kerosene that's actually quite expensive, that you used to use to get a very poor level of lighting for a few hours, right? So that savings that you have there, plus you might be, and this actually happens for very poor households, you might be charging some of your neighbors for them to charge their phones at your house, for example. So you have these small drips of income that you can use, hopefully, to get the next step up, the next solar panel, so you can graduate to a higher level of supply. After, you know, you've graduated to a somewhat bigger panel, you might say, well, now I can afford a small refrigerator, so I can start selling refrigerated drinks in my community, right? Or I might be earning some money that I can then use, not use for my household connection, but I might be renting space at a commercial refrigeration facility. So, for example, a lot of poor people that have, you know, cattle, et cetera, don't have the wherewithal to refrigerate the meat from the animals that they've slaughtered. But they can pay for rental space in a facility that somebody has put in that's an investor into that. So it's refrigeration as a service, not refrigeration as something you own, right? So you can channel that into renting space there that might improve your agricultural production. At some point, that income you might use to basically have some pumping so that the land that you irrigate, you know, increases your agricultural output. So all these are steps you can take to graduate up the ladder. But I think one of the things that everybody's looking at, and, you know, it's not like we have all the answers, but is how do we accelerate the process of people moving up that ladder?
So let me ask you a question, okay, then about this off-grid. That's related to the question we started off about reliability. This is something that is going to be mostly run by non-traditional utilities, like different companies. Are there reliability issues with off-grid? Even if they're not, even if they're like systems that are tier 3 and above, is there any reliability issues, and is there a way to know? Do they face reliability issues just the same way that the grid faces reliability issues? Let's say, for example, if you are a small, I don't know, manufacturing or rice miller or you know, whatever, right, in a small like secondary town, and you're relying on this off-grid technology, would you face reliability issues?
I mean, you would, if you, especially if you look at it as a like-to-like, right? What we see in off-grid communities that haven't had access before and are served by a mini grid is that they adapt very quickly to the circumstances of the supply. So a mini grid operator may explain to them that if you want cheap and affordable power, the main demand in this small town is between, you know, 7 in the morning and 8 or 9 at night, right? So I'm going to provide ample, affordable power during that time. During the nighttime, I either have to invest in a massive amount of batteries or run a genset, so that power will be more expensive. So we've seen a high adaptability to that from businesses. And frankly, you know, in a rural setting, you know, not having availability at nighttime or, you know, in the really dark hours of the day, it hasn't been a huge constraint on growth.
Franz, let me come back to you about this. So this interplay between off-grid and this desire and the reform to make utilities more financially viable, right? The more off-grid you have, the more likely that these utilities are going to rely on revenues from those sources, because the off-grid is, unless the off-grid is being run by the utility, but if it is not running the off-grid supply, those are customers they can't get revenues from, right? So how do you see these two contentious issues, right? Like, on the one hand, we're pushing off-grid, which is probably provided by private actors. And on the other hand, we want the utilities to be financially viable, but a whole lot of customers are probably closed off from them.
It's a great question, and that's why, let me come back to the five pillars of the compact, right? So pillar three, as I mentioned, is doing this least cost electrification plan. Let's say you're a country, this is the average of sub-Saharan Africa, that has 50, 52, 53% average electricity access. So you have to say, well, how are the 47% that currently are unserved, are they going to be served? Which are the areas that reasonably within the next 10 years, the public utility can't grow into, right? Because they're too far away from transmission lines, etc. So you might decide those are areas that I'm going to allow the private sector to electrify with these results-based CapEx subsidies, right? You have to give that private investor, though, a little bit of a sense of security that the minute he finishes his system, the public utility isn't going to move in and steal his customers. Of course, right? He's making a significant capital investment. He deserves to have some legal and some predictability to know that those customers will be his for a certain amount of time, right? So I don't think that these two things are at odds. As a matter of fact, these customers in rural areas, remember, they tend to be the poor parts of the population. So from a utility point of view, those aren't easy customers to serve, to bill, and to collect from anyway, right? These private mini-grid developers are very good at finding ways to bill customers in small increments in a way that works for poor customers. But it's not like the utilities are falling over themselves and saying, can't wait to electrify that rural village. I mean, that's
But off-grid is not entering small towns?
It can, yeah, it can. And so in Chad, for example, one characteristic in Chad is that you have a number of towns that lend themselves very good to mini grids that we're trying to find private operators for. But private operators that with a CapEx subsidy are able to recover investment costs in the way that the public utility would never be agile enough to do. So the two aren't at odds. You just have to define what's the universe that in some reasonable amount of time is likely to be an area that the public utility, typically public, can grow into, and what are the areas that you're going to seed to private investment and with, of course, all the public safeguards.
But is that an arrangement that is being worked out within the Mission 300, or is that just organically?
It's very much part of Mission 300. I mean, when we look at the electrification plan of a country, we can identify based on various algorithms and cost parameters whether an area is more sort of suitable for a mini grid or an off-grid solution than grid extension, right? I mean, take a country like Madagascar, for instance. They are running more than 100 isolated grids by the government right now. And simply the country is very vast, and the grid is only covering, 10% maybe of the surface, right? So in an electrification plan of Madagascar, off-grid solutions will be, I would say, the majority, at least spatially, of the connections and of the service, both from the government side and from the private sector side. And all this technology development we talked about, even if it has a cost, solar, battery, etc., just opens up brand new avenues to serve these areas was very expensive.
But if these are poor areas, what makes these off-grid farms attracted to go to these poor areas?
Well, one thing is, because people have asked us this, could Mission 300 have happened a decade ago? And our answer is maybe not in the same way. Because one thing that's a wind at our back, and I think at everybody's back, is that because the cost of solar panels has come down so dramatically, and with a slight offset a little bit later, the cost of battery storage has also come down. Suddenly, it's not so preposterous to think that you can bring electricity access, even for 4, 5, 6 hours, outside the daylight hours, to rural, quite poor and dispersed communities that wouldn't have been feasible maybe 10, 15 years ago, but is increasingly feasible to the point where it can be done with a relatively modest one-off CapEx subsidy, not even an OpEx subsidy. You're not subsidizing the operation of these systems. What you're doing is providing a little bit of a carrot to make private developers go to areas where the economics don't quite work out for that initial capital expense right now. But increasingly, the amount that you need to actually entice the private sector to move in these areas is coming down. So periodically in Nigeria, for example, we have to actually look again if we're offering too much of a carrot. You have to be very, of course, careful with public resources that you're not overpaying the private sector for moving into an area who would have gone anyway, right? So,
And let's keep in mind that this is not unique to Africa, right? How were rural U.S. electrified under the New Deal and in the early stages? It was through cooperatives, various sometimes connected, but sometimes non-connected solutions, smaller grids that eventually grew into kind of the national backbone, right? So I don't think it's necessarily a negative. I think the sooner towns and villages can get a reliable supply, it's a lot better than no supply, even if the cost can be, higher than in the capital at first. It does provide a tremendous opportunity for productive activities.
So let me ask you one, maybe the last two questions, and then we can wrap this up. You've been energy specialists in this area for quite a while now, right? And you've seen all kinds of technologies change around this. How do you see the mix of energy evolve in Africa in the next decade or two? Is it going to be mostly just renewables and small mini grids that supply, towns? And if that is the case, what's the future of utilities in that case? This is now a question for you to speculate.
Yeah, perhaps. I think that's a very interesting question. But you have to be thinking about this question.
You're in this business, you're in this industry. You have to be thinking about, how is this industry evolving?
The reason it's tough is that I always say we are in the most dramatic change in the energy industry globally since probably Edison, right? With the emergence at scale of all these technologies and the confluence with AI and digitalization, right? So we get surprised every week on prices of solar parks wherever or new applications, right? But I think that there's also an aspect of Africa energy that will not change, right? We have to develop a much more viable, more commercial business model for energy, right? Because this technology shift requires resources, it requires attention, and you cannot afford to be left behind. And as Africa grows and as, industrial activities, manufacturing, et cetera, builds in bigger cities, there's going to be the energy sectors are going to look much more like what we see in Europe or Asia or the US, right?
Can you industrialize heavily with just solar and wind?
I don't think so. And I think what you're going to see in West and Central Africa over the next few decades is a big increase in solar and in wind in some cases, but also a scale up of gas to power electricity generation. I think you'll see less and less, hopefully, heavy fuel oil, less and less diesel. So I think the big focus should be on moving out of the dirtiest sources, the dirtiest ones, which are also the most expensive ones. So even for reasons beyond climate mitigation, which of course are legitimate and important, there are reasons for utilities to exit these dirty sources of thermal generation because they just burn a hole in their pocket, right? So I think what you're going to see is electricity generation is going to have to grow dramatically. It grows faster than the rate of growth. So typically, if you have economies like right now, I think in sub-Saharan Africa, next year you're projecting just over 4% growth, I'm sure you'll have electricity demand growing by 6, 7, and more percent. So if you're a government, you're constantly on the cusp of keeping up with that demand. If you miss a beat, you're going to have load shedding, you're going to have rationing, et cetera. No government wants to do that, right? So the energy sector has a wonderful way of focusing the mind of decision makers, not just the Minister of Energy in the utility, but the Minister of Finance, because that loss-making utility is his problem or her problem as much as it is the energy minister's problem. So I think you'll see that shift, more renewables, but also more gas to power. We're hoping, and that's the first pillar of the compact, that you'll see more of that generation acquired by competitive means. What we find is in a lot of countries that have never sourced any generation competitively, they're surprised when you do a competitive tender at how low the prices come out. So even comparing the solar plant that's competitively tendered versus the solar plant that somebody gave you without competition, there's several cents per kilowatt hours of difference. And what we say to countries is, just try the market. Set a price in the market. That way, if anybody that comes afterwards and offers you a single source deal, you know what the price reference point is. The market has told you. So you're in a much stronger bargaining position because you know how low the price could go.
Okay, final question. Mission 300 correctly has been dubbed as very ambitious and long overdue, right? And that's great. But even if we achieve all the goals of Mission 300, we've only solved half the problem of people who don't have connections in Africa. So what more would you like to see from players across the energy landscape in order to fully power the region's economies? Who would like to go first?
Okay, I'll start and I'll be a little bit boring in as much as what we like to see, at least the intent of it, is largely laid out in the compacts. And the idea with the Mission 300 compacts is not to provide a roadmap for 4 years to achieve our Mission 300 target, but really put the sector on a sustainable footing to grow more organically and more commercially for the long run, because we need to set up our sectors for a 100-year growth path. These are countries that are growing in population, growing their economies, growing the diversity of their activities, and energy is just the absolute foundation for that. If we can't keep up, if we can't serve that demand, we're going to falter, right? So that's the goal to me.
I think the bet is African Development Bank and the World Bank alone, even working with governments and governments committed to real reforms, those players alone aren't going to be able to solve this problem. You need to create an environment where private investors will want to come in at a scale that they're not currently present in, right? So the whole idea is the World Bank and African Development Bank, and not just us, but other development partners who pledged $6 billion in financing for the sector at the Dar es Salaam Energy Summit in January of this year. Those guys will come in, but it's going to take sort of a system that self-reinforces. Countries make reforms, the private sector takes note, leans on governments to go even further, begins to invest more, and more development partners come in from the sideline and put more money on the table. Because otherwise, we're not going to be able to break even the 300 goal. You're right, we have to go more. It's not just that we're leaving 300 million unattended of the people who didn't have power in 2024 when we started, but populations are growing, right? So it's a moving target that you're trying to hit.
Franz Erik, thank you for breaking down how Mission 300 is tackling one of Africa's most urgent development challenges. I especially appreciate your openness in discussing the tough policy choices and the real potential for energy access to drive economic transformation. To our listeners, if you are interested in how the World Bank is helping power up more and better jobs across the continent, visit worldbank.org/Africa to learn more.